is Killian and Bailey versus International Union of Operating Engineers.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Shelley Hammack here for the appellants, Mr. Bailey and Mr. Killian. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Proceed, please. Thank you.
Okay. This is an interesting case in that it deals with the applicable statute of limitations relating to the unauthorized practice of law committed by a union representative, in this case, Mr. McBee. It is different in kind than the average case wherein a union representative negotiates a settlement of a union claim. It is different in kind in that in this case there was a specific amount negotiated for resolution of non-union claims that include costs, including attorney's fees. It was negotiated while the
question about that. Your clients were free to pursue those claims if they didn't find those offers acceptable. Is that correct?
That is correct. But they were put in the position of either having to accept what was negotiated by the union representative, which included resolution of those claims, or lose their union claims as well.
Well, wasn't the union free to decide not to pursue arbitration without negotiating those settlements, just to make a business decision that this costs a lot of money, this doesn't look like a very successful case, and we think that the prudent use of our collective resources says don't arbitrate this one?
Well, and I understand that the standards that apply to unions apply to is consideration of the union as a whole and all of its members. And yes, under certain circumstances, they definitely can decide something like that. In this
you used the phrase that they had to choose between. And on the one hand, you indicated they had to choose between compromising their personal civil claims. And then you contrasted that with their union claims. But they don't actually have any union claims, and they never did. The union had claims.
Yes, sir.
That did not belong to them.
Yes. And I agree.
So what was it that they lost if they never had it?
They still lost. They still have a right to fair representation and for the union to represent them. The union had agreed to take their matter to arbitration. So it's not that there isn't a standard that applies to the union in deciding whether or not to represent an individual member. There is.
Well, that agreement was subject to a membership vote, was it not?
Yes, it was.
Membership had said later, we don't want you to do that.
No, Your Honor. The membership voted to pursue.
I know they didn't, but they could have. We don't know at the time what the membership vote would be necessarily, do we?
No, because it was never put to the membership. What happened was the union members voted to pursue arbitration. Later on, the board decided not to. We know that now. There was never any member vote on the decision not to. The members, just like my clients, I believe understood that it was going to arbitration. And I think what's important, one of the things that I
what is the harm?
The harm to my clients?
Yes. As you put it, being forced to choose.
Well, because if they chose to accept the offer that was presented and negotiated by the union, they would lose the right to pursue their civil claims.
No, what's the harm that they didn't choose to accept that offer? Weren't all of their claims, all of their potential recoveries available in the civil action?
Yes, they were. But then the issue becomes, and I'll say that defendant argues in their brief that there wasn't sufficient facts to support a duty of fair representation claim or the underlying breach claim or those things. That was not before the trial court. The only issue before the trial court was the statute of limitations.
We can affirm on any grounds supported by the record, can we not?
Well, I believe I think the issue has to be brought before the trial court. If it's not brought before the trial court, we don't respond to it in our response to motion for summary judgment.
That's why we're asking you some questions.
Oh, okay, Your Honor. But we didn't respond to that issue, so we didn't have the opportunity to put that evidence forward. We put the evidence forward.
You've told us that they could pursue all of the claims that they own if they rejected the school district's offer.
Yes, they could.
And so Judge Applewick asked you, what's the harm then? They had the claims they had before, and they still have those claims. The claims that weren't pursued didn't belong to them.
Well, there is still a duty of fair representation that applies.
But what's the harm from breach of that duty?
The harm from breach of that duty,
assuming there was one,
it puts the plaintiffs in a bad position. Either they have to give up the union's representation of them in their claims, or they have to pursue them civilly. And it put them in direct conflict with the union representative who had negotiated a specific amount for settlement of their civil claims.
Who appears to have negotiated for them the best resolution anyone had ever had for one of those types of claims, and to have used the threat of arbitration belonging to the union to the members' advantage.
That is what the union representative indicated. But it could have been very well that it was the best claim that the union ever negotiated, because, in fact, they negotiated for plaintiffs' resolution of their civil claims, including attorney's fees, while refusing to allow their attorney to be present during the negotiations, and without the benefit of counsel there. They did it outside of the scope of their authority. They had no authority to do that under the collective bargaining agreement.
Well, you'd agree counsel had no authority to bargain the union's claims with the school district, private counsel.
Absolutely not. Yeah, I agree.
So
yes.
So what role could counsel conceivably play in the room?
They could represent the plaintiffs, advise them, negotiate with the school district regarding their non-union claims.
Is the school district's insertion of the civil claims being settled in that grievance itself an unfair labor practice?
It could be, but and I believe it is. I believe it's beyond the scope of the collective bargaining agreement. And Mr. McBee testified it was. Thank you,
Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. Kathy Barnard for Operating Engineers, Local 609. I think I'd like to start out picking up from your questions, and then I want to go to the statute of limitations issue. It sounds like the court is very familiar with the duty of fair representation and balancing act the union has there, so I'll leave that unless
well,
you have
why questions. Didn't the union insist that the language about civil claims and attorney's fees be removed from the offer?
Your Honor, you asked whether that's an unfair labor practice, and that's unclear under the PIRA, the state statute. It used to be an unfair labor.
The union has no authority to settle private claims of the individuals that don't arise under the collective bargaining agreement.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. But whether asserting another condition that isn't a mandatory subject of bargaining is itself an unfair labor practice hasn't been decided by PERC. And since the Supreme Court decision in Payette, U.S. Supreme Court decision, it's become unclear whether asserting that in this context was an unfair labor practice or would have been under the NLRA. That's the best I can answer you. I can also tell you there's evidence in the record, in the clerk's papers, that this is what happens in a lot of negotiations. Employers assert that, yes, we want to settle, but we also want to settle those claims. What was happening at this mediation was that Mr. McBee was attempting to negotiate, as was said a minute ago, a good settlement for the grievance and leave the option open for the grievance slash potential plaintiffs to assert those claims if they didn't like the offer that was being made. And the record is very clear that the appellants consulted with their counsel over that issue, and they rejected those offers. And, in fact, in the lawsuit in which they sue the union for DFR and for this negligent or unauthorized practice of law, they also sue the district asserting their claim.
But how can the union recommend to the membership that it's a good settlement, even if it's the highest cash value, when it includes claims of the individuals that the union has no right to settle and the union should expect will not be acceptable? I mean, that's saying, here, let's get us off the hook for representation because we know they're going to reject it and we know we can't get better from the district.
Well, first of all, we didn't know they would reject it. That wasn't clear. But
counsel had expressed concern that McBee was not entitled to represent the civil claims. And the attorney's fees.
Your Honor, he didn't. He didn't. The district made a proposal at one point that included a breakout for attorney's fees. That was the district dealing with the grievance. All Mr. McBee and Perk was dealing with was the union's grievance. No resolution was made with regard to the grievance without the plaintiffs, now appellants, being able to consult with counsel.
So would it be fair to characterize Mr. B's role in this as simply passing on the offer of the district without taking any affirmative steps at the time of the district's first offer to settle?
I don't know what you mean by first time, but during the mediation.
He at least told the school district, I'm assuming, that one isn't going to be acceptable by the plaintiffs. You need to put more money on the table if you want this to go away.
Right, but he never made an affirmative offer that would have been final without the plaintiff's counsel.
So he was Henry Kissinger between the plaintiffs and the school district?
The mediator was. This happened in a Public Employment Relation Commission
meeting. The one communicating to plaintiffs what school district's offers are in the private
class. Yeah, and I think it's really important, and it may help the court to understand that the document that settled the case did not include any of that language. The document that settled the case was an agreement between the union and the district, not signed by any plaintiff/appellant, that simply said, district, make this offer, and in return, we will withdraw the grievance. This is the best we can do for these folks. And the plaintiff's counsel, if she thinks she can get more, can work on it after us. This is what we'll do. You offer this. If they take it, fine. If they don't, they can go sue. And they did.
But there was no response that the union will accept this offer as long as you take out the reference to the civil claims, which we have no authority to accept.
What the record discloses on that, Your Honor, is that Mr. McBee said, I don't have authority to decide that. The union can't decide that. You need to talk to counsel about it.
But he recommended the union accept the settlement if the offer was made that contained that term, instead of saying,
yes,
we can't.
Yes, but what he was settling was the grievance, not those claims. He was leaving the plaintiffs free to pursue their public law claims on their own. What he was saying is we'd settled this.
Let me ask you this a different way. What did the union get out of the settlement? It had its right was to grieve the terminations. And it said, we're not going to go any further in the grievance process.
Okay. Your Honor, this is in the clerk's papers. I don't know if it's in the briefing, but it is in the clerk's papers. The appellant put in the entire declaration or deposition of Mr. McBee. The union was pursuing this case more on the district's failure to do a proper investigation than it was on the merits of the case. It was a very difficult case from the merits point of view. What the what the union wanted to establish was that the district was not doing a good job investigating its members, and if they were going to fire people, they need to be able to prove it. And so the motivation for that, moving that case to arbitration, was that. And when the money got so high as a potential for these individuals, the union thought, well, this is better for these individuals to be offered this money than for us to, you know, continue on with the case. It had been through three steps of the grievance process already, and the district had sort of learned its lesson from the union's point of view. And I want to point out a question you asked earlier. What happened as far as the vote to take this to arbitration was initially there was a decision to take it to arbitration. That decision was taken at the advice of Mr. McBee, who said, if I can increase this offer, I might come back to you and ask you to change your mind. The membership, this is a union of school district employees, non-certificated, and they weren't around.
Gave the board authority.
Exactly.
They weren't going to meet during the summer.
Right, and that's what happened. That's what happened. So that, and that was entirely communicated to the plaintiffs several times, and it on September 17th, on October 12th, on October 14th, and on October 16th in writing. That case was not going to arbitration, and that is why the statute of limitations was gone by the time the plaintiffs filed the lawsuit. This case is presenting some interesting issues of first impression for Washington courts about the duty of fair representation subsuming the common law claim. I haven't had much time to talk about that. I'd like to for a minute. And then
we don't get to any of them, aren't you?
I'm sorry?
You're telling us we don't get to any of those interesting questions. We follow Division III and say the statute of limitations makes us go away.
Yes, I am. Are there other questions from the court? Or I'll... No? All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Your Honors. So just to clarify a few issues, while it may be a union or typical, and I shouldn't say typical, it's happened that a union has agreed to settle a grievance when an employer asks for a total release of all claims. What is different in this case is when a union representative specifically negotiates an amount. For resolution of the civil claims, including attorney's fees.
The counsel tells us there wasn't really a negotiation. The district gave one number, and they say, no, that's not good enough, and the district was bidding against itself, essentially, until they got to a number that the union said, you know, we think you should take that, Mr. Plaintiff.
There was, if you look at the record, originally the school district presented a settlement agreement that had blanks in it, but the blanks included a non-wage claims for general damages and costs, which were attorney's fees.
And presumably that was for tax reporting purposes.
Well, it's for attorney's fees. The only attorney's fees the clients had were mine.
Well, if the clients recover wages, they have to report them as income. If it's all general damages, they don't.
All right, but that's not, it's been acknowledged by the parties, Mr. McBee included, that was to cover attorney's fees.
But those sections were not in the final document, were they?
Well, interestingly, the document that the board voted on was the document that was presented to my clients last that included the breakdown. Apparently, the document that was signed, which we didn't see until the litigation, after the litigation, in discovery, included just the full amount. But it's the full amount including the amount that was negotiated for resolution of their non-union civil claims and the attorney's fees. So we had no knowledge of that other agreement. We hadn't seen it. Contrary to what was represented by opposing counsel is the facts of the case.
But if that's the one they voted on, that's the one the district was obligated to offer to you, was it not? So if the district didn't offer you what they voted on.
Yes, but what they voted on wasn't at the actual agreement that was entered into between the union and the school district. It included the same amounts, for both of the claims, both union and non-union claims. But it wasn't the same agreement.
Well, if that makes a difference, couldn't you have gone back and said, listen, school district, you have to allocate per the vote? I mean, how
well, they, I suppose they could have and clarified that what the union was resolving. I mean, but
how does that advance your case, whether it was segregated or not?
Well, it shows specifically that they resolved plaintiffs' non-union claims. That's why. Mm-hmm. And negotiated
for it. Well, we all agree they didn't resolve them. Your client could say no.
Well, that's true. But we believe there is an important issue regarding the statute of limitation in this case, specifically the unauthorized practice of law and the statute that applies when a union member acts outside of the CBA.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court will be in recess.
All right.